Welcome to Audio Notes. I'm David Finkel, Artistic Director of Music at Menlo, and it is my great pleasure to introduce you to the festival's 2014 season, Around Dvorak. Music at Menlo's 2014 season explores dual facets of the unfolding of Western music throughout the classical and romantic eras and into the 20th century. Catalyzed by a lineage of composers from Haydn and Mozart, through Schubert and Brahms, to Schoenberg, Webern, and Berg a generation later, Vienna emerged as the epicenter of a dynamic musical tradition that remains central to the canon today. Meanwhile, starting in the latter half of the 19th century, the folk traditions of Hungary, Romania, and the Czech lands permeated Western classical music, as composers like Bedřich Smetana, Leoš Janáček, Béla Bartók, and Zoltán Kodály awakened to the richness of their own musical heritage and sought to cultivate a distinct musical voice. At the center of this dialectic was Antonín Dvořák, the self-described simple Czech musicant who likewise possessed the romantic ferocity of his mentor, Johannes Brahms. No other composer so fluently integrated the dual traditions of Western classicism and Central European folk music, developing a distinct musical language whose influence would be felt as far as the United States. This season, Music at Menlo offers 8 colorful concert programs that revolve around Dvorak, taking listeners on a thrilling journey between Vienna, Prague, and other fascinating musical destinations along the way. Audio notes are designed to enhance your enjoyment and deepen your appreciation of the music you'll be hearing at the festival. I'll be joined by artistic co-director Wu Han, Audio Notes author and producer Patrick Castillo, and some of this season's festival artists to offer historical and cultural context and a variety of perspectives on this summer's concert programs. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to seeing you at the festival. Having achieved great renown for developing a distinctly Czech musical voice, Antonín Dvořák received an invitation in 1891 to lead the National Conservatory in New York and guide a rising generation of composers in discovering a distinctly American musical voice. Alongside his famous American String Quartet and From the New World Symphony, this period produced Dvořák's Sonatina for Violin and Piano, a lesser-known work but one equally shaped by his experience in the United States. Following Dvořák's Sonatina, Concert Program 5 offers The Union, Louis Moreau Gottschalk's riotous pastiche of great American tunes, from The Star-Spangled Banner to Yankee Doodle. Charles Ives, widely regarded as the patriarch of this country's classical music, composed songs that capture a singularly American character in their own right. In our own time, the modern maverick George Crumb has turned his kaleidoscopic ear to the American songbook, reimagining such tunes as Swing Low, Sweet Chariot into ethereal soundscapes.
So what did the American musical landscape look like when Dvořák came to the United States in 1892? What did Dvořák's America sound like? In the minds of many music lovers, the story of American classical music begins in the first half of the 20th century, with composers like Charles Ives, Henry Cowell, and Ruth Crawford Seeger. Or some listeners might start with Edward McDowell, Amy Beach, and others, American composers who wrote music in a European romantic style. But with this summer's 5th concert program, American Visions, we begin with a composer who better captures the spirit of American music in the late 19th century. Composer and pianist Louis Moreau Gottschalk, born in New Orleans in 1829, was the first American classical musician to achieve international renown. When he was a teenager, his father sent him to study in Paris, where Gottschalk subsequently launched his career with a hugely successful recital debut in 1849. Critics at the time compared him to Chopin. 2 years later, he toured to Spain, where the Queen took a liking to him, and he became a national idol. In 1853, Gottschalk returned to the United States and became a huge star here as well. The lion's share of his compositional output was his solo piano music, whose dazzling virtuosity was tailored to his own gifts as a performer, and which became enormously popular. He mastered all of the popular musical styles of the day and incorporated them into his music. He referenced the songs of Stephen Foster and other popular American songwriters in his own work, but transfigured them with an irreverent audacity that we more immediately associate with Charles Ives, who was born 5 years after Gottschalk's death. We hear that audacity in his patriotic work for piano, The Union, a concert paraphrase on the national airs Star-Spangled Banner, Yankee Doodle, and Hail Columbia. In 1891, Antonin Dvorak received an invitation from Jeanette Thurber, president of the newly founded National Conservatory in New York, to come to America. The 50-year-old Dvorak had by this time achieved great renown, not only as one of his generation's most original composers, but particularly as a champion of the music of his native Czechoslovakia. Thurber aspired to foster a uniquely American school of classical composition, and saw Dvorak as the man to guide America's young composers in finding their voice. Dvorak accepted the invitation and set sail with his family for a 9-day crossing of the Atlantic, arriving on September 26, 1892. His arrival garnered much fanfare. He made his United States debut as a conductor at Carnegie Hall the following month, leading his Te Deum, on which occasion another prominent arts patron, Thomas Wentworth Higginson, addressed the audience to express his hope that Dvorak, quote, may help add the new world of music to the continent which Columbus found, end quote. Dvorak understood America's expectations. He wrote to a friend back home, quote, the Americans expect great things of me. I am to show them the way into the promised land, the realm of a new, independent art, in short, a national style of music. This will certainly be a great and lofty task, and I hope that with God's help I shall succeed in it. End quote. Dvorak sought to lead by example, and during his time in America, produced some of his most beloved music, incorporating what he heard in African-American spirituals, Southern plantation songs, and Native American folk music. In May of 1893, he completed his 9th symphony, nicknamed From the New World. Immediately following these came two of his most famous chamber works, The American Quartet and the String Quintet in E-flat major, also called The American. In the winter, he added another American chamber work, the Sonatina in G major for violin and piano, Opus 100. Dvorak composed the Sonatina quickly. He began on November 19, 1893, and finished on December 3rd. And though it tends to get overshadowed by the American Quartet and Quintet, it's an exquisitely charming work and a key part of Dvorak's output during his American years. The work is cast in 4 movements. The first movement, marked Allegro Risoluto, begins with a confident theme. In signature fashion, Dvorak sets a countrified melody to a proudly dotted rhythmic gait. The second theme, in E minor, responds with a gentle plaintiveness. That plaintiveness intensifies in the second movement, Larghetto, which has earned the nickname Indian Lament. Thank you. It won't come as a surprise that Dvorak was fiercely in love with his homeland, and the decision to leave for America wasn't an easy one. As fulfilling as he found his work in the United States, he spent his years in this country painfully homesick. In fact, 3 years after his arrival, he returned to Bohemia and sent word back to Jeanette Thurber that he was breaking his contract and not coming back. That homesickness is piercingly audible in the slow movements of his American pieces, most famously in the Largo of his New World Symphony, in which the wistfulness is so strong that a student of Dvorak wrote lyrics to it and adapted it into the now-famous faux-spiritual Going Home. The Larghetto of the G major sonatina, though not nearly as famous, is no less poignant. Dvorak sets his melancholy aside for the spirited joie de vivre of the third movement scherzo. The guileless finale begins with a lively hoedown. A second theme appears, in E minor, but free of the doleful air encountered in the first and second movements. Here, the music sustains its spirited, dance-like energy. Any sense of agitation quickly dissipates as a sweet E major melody arises, marked molto tranquillo. After some working over of these three thematic ideas, the exuberance of the opening measures returns, and the sonatina gallops to its final cadence. The truth is, for as much as Dvorak contributed to the cultural life of the United States during his time here, he can't ultimately be credited with showing American composers the way into the promised land. No single composer can lay claim to that. Over the last 100+ years, there have been generations of musical pioneers, visionary composers, who have played important roles in shaping the rich miscellany of styles that makes the field of American music. But while it's true that there hasn't been one Moses-like figure to lead the charge, neither has there been a more important or influential figure for American music than Charles Ives. In much the same way that Beethoven continued to resonate with every European composer throughout the 19th century, so has American music in the 20th and early 21st centuries owed a great debt to Charles Ives. Born in Danbury, Connecticut in 1874, Ives is widely regarded as the 20th century's leading American composer of concert music. His innovative approach to the fundamental musical principles of harmony, rhythm, and structure laid the groundwork for subsequent generations of American composers. Ives's early musical training came from his father, George Ives, a multi-instrumentalist and band leader. Through his father, Ives absorbed a wide range of musical styles, from the classical European canon to American popular music and Protestant hymns. A number of anecdotal images of George Ives's unconventional methods of instruction have furthermore persevered, as if prophecies of innovations to be realized later in Ives's music. For instance, the young Charles Ives singing songs in their original key while his father played the piano accompaniment in a different key. Or George Ives sitting with his son on the roof of their house to listen as two marching bands came towards each other from different sides of town. Whether or not such images are apocryphal, they do nevertheless point to musical phenomena that Ives would later explore, such as using multiple tonalities, rhythms, and sonorities to create the effect of multiple layers of music happening at once. Charles Ives's adventurous and oftentimes fearlessly dissonant music puzzled many of his contemporaries and failed to reach a mainstream audience during much of Ives's life. Thus unable to achieve commercial success through his music, but unwilling to compromise his rigorous compositional language, Ives led a remarkable double life. By day, he spearheaded one of the country's most successful insurance companies. At night, on weekends, and even on the train during his morning commute, Ives composed, tirelessly extending the boundaries of musical tradition. On our fifth concert program this summer, we hear a selection of Charles Ives's songs, of which he composed some 200 throughout his career. Ives's songs are remarkable for their sheer character. In the intimate musical context of solo voice and piano, Ives is by turns playful, poignant, audacious, and always, somehow, uncannily able to capture and express something quintessentially American.
Another good cowpuncher has gone to meet his fate. I hope he'll find a resting place within the Golden Gate, the Golden Gate. Another place is vacant on the ranch of the Exciting.
Ives's song In Flanders Fields sets a text by John McCrae, a Canadian poet who fought in the First World War. In Flanders fields the poppies blow between the crosses, row on row, that mark our place, and in the sky the larks still bravely singing fly, scarce heard amidst the guns below. We are the dead. Short days ago we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved, and now we lie in Flanders fields. Ives wrote his own text for one of his finest songs, The Things Our Fathers Loved, to which is appended the subtitle, And the Greatest of These Was Liberty. It's a short song, but in which Ives, in signature fashion, weaves references to Dixie, My Old Kentucky Home, and other popular American tunes.
I think
Ives once wrote about a memorable walk he took with his wife along the Housatonic River near Stockbridge, Massachusetts. Ives recalled that they, quote, heard the distant singing from across the river. The mist had not entirely left the riverbed, and the colors, the running water, the banks and elm trees were something that one would always remember, end quote. This memory was the inspiration for the final movement of his first orchestral set, which he subsequently adapted into a song, using a text by Robert Underwood Johnson. Following the songs of Charles Ives, Concert Program 5 concludes with undoubtedly one of the most extraordinary takes on the classic American songbook. Born in Charleston, West Virginia, in 1929, George Crumb first rose to prominence in the 1960s, becoming possibly the most widely performed American composer of the mid-1980s. Crumb largely made his reputation as a great innovator of instrumental timbre and extended techniques. His best-known works include the string quartet Black Angels, which requires the players to shout, bow crystal glasses, and otherwise produce sounds not commonly associated with the quartet repertoire, and Music for a Summer Evening, a work for two pianos and a large percussion battery, which likewise displays Crumb's endlessly imaginative approach to musical sound. Crumb has offered the following reflection on the nature of music. Quote, I have always considered music to be a very strange substance, a substance endowed with magical properties. Music is tangible, almost palpable, and yet unreal, elusive. Music is analyzable only on the most mechanistic level. The important elements, the spiritual impulse, the psychological curve, the metaphysical implications, are understandable only in terms of the music itself. I feel intuitively that music must have been the primeval cell from which language, science, and religion originated. End quote. Since 2001, George Crumb has produced 6 installments of his American songbook arrangements. Each is set for solo voice, amplified piano, and percussion. This summer, we hear Book 2, subtitled A Journey Beyond Time. The set begins with the familiar tune Swing Low, Sweet Chariot, but unlike you've probably ever imagined it.
Mm-hmm.
The impetus behind these fantastical arrangements was the composer's daughter, the singer and actress Anne Crumb. Again in the composer's words, quote, "The original impulse to compose a cycle of Appalachian folk song settings came about through a suggestion of my daughter Anne, who had long been interested in American folk music, and in particular those haunting tunes associated with Appalachia. She hoped I might find inspiration for an extended work suitable for concert performance. In undertaking the task, I was, in a sense, returning to my own Appalachian roots. Indeed, these beautiful and haunting melodies were always a part of my musical psyche, and in many of my earlier compositions, I had quoted fragments of these tunes as a sort of symbolic and very personal musical signature. This present work represents a selection of my very favorite pieces of the genre. In confronting these songs head-on, so to speak, I determined to leave the beautiful melodies intact, since one could not hope to improve on their pristine perfection. In the matter of the folk song texts, I found a huge variety of alternate versions, and my daughter and I simply chose our favorites. I have attempted to heighten the expressiveness of this music by scoring the work for a rather unusual orchestra, consisting of a quartet of percussionists, who play a number of rather unconventional instruments in addition to the more common ones, and amplified piano. By means of a wide range of timbres and textures, together with the use of an extended chromaticism and occasionally unusual rhythmic patterns, I have attempted to bring out the psychological depth and mysticism, and also the humor, both whimsical and ironic, inherent in Appalachian folklore. If my settings of these wonderful songs will enhance the listener's enjoyment, I would feel that my creative efforts were truly rewarded." End quote. One of the set's most compelling moments is Crumb's setting of Go Down Moses. Crumb sets the story of Moses demanding the freedom of the Israelites to a fearsome sounding battery of bass drums, tam-tams, bells, gongs, and lion's roar. Crumb marks the music to be played dramatically in an oracular, apocalyptic style. The piano signals the severity of the scene, playing the Gregorian Dies Irae plainchant melody. The set closes with an enigmatic setting of Sometimes I Feel Like a Motherless Child. Audio notes are authored and produced by Patrick Castillo and narrated by David Finkel, Patrick Castillo, and Wu Han. Additional mastering is provided by Dahong Situ. Musical excerpts on this disc appear courtesy of the following artists and organizations. Dvorak Sonatina for Violin and Piano is performed by violinist Kai Gloystein and pianist Catherine Ordronov, and appears courtesy of AV Records. Louis Moreau Gottschalk's The Union, performed by Philip Martin, and Charles Ives's Songs, performed by baritone Gerald Finley and pianist Julius Drake, appear courtesy of Hyperion Records. George Crumb's American Songbook II, A Journey Beyond Time, performed by Barbara Ann Martin and Orchestra 2001, conducted by James Freeman, appears courtesy of Bridge Records. Brahms's six pieces for piano, Opus 118, are performed by Wu Han and appear on Artist Led Records. Anton Webern's two early pieces and three pieces, Opus 11, for cello and piano, performed by cellist Clemens Hagen and pianist Oleg Meisenberg. And Leos Janacek's Concertino, performed by Rudolf Verkusny and the Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra, appear courtesy of Deutsche Grammophon. Janacek's Melodi, performed by flautist Carol Winsens, oboist Alan Vogel, clarinetist Anthony McGill, bass clarinetist Carrie Bell, bassoonist Frank Morelli, and hornist Richard Todd, appears courtesy of Music at Menlo Live. Dvorak's String Sextet in A Major, Opus 48, is performed by violinists Joseph Silverstein and Annika Vafian, violists Mark Holloway and Paul Neubauer, and cellists Andreas Brantelid and Fred Sherry, and appears courtesy of the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. Audio Notes is a copyrighted production of Artist Led.